This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the state's Joint Finance Committee voted yesterday to put some money behind fighting PFAS contamination in Wisconsin water. We'll talk to a state senator on the committee and look at a proposal he co-sponsored that would create grants to help communities deal with the problem. Now, during the height of the pandemic, a lot of people turned to the kitchen as a source of comfort and self-care when we weren't leaving the house so much and wanted something to make us feel good. As it turns out, baking can play a complementary role for our mental health as a way of dealing with stress, finding joy, and practicing mindfulness. So much so that our next guest has incorporated as part of how he treats patients at his therapy practice. It's Food Friday, and we're learning all about how baking can be good for the mind, body, and soul. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does baking affect your mental health? Does it help you relieve stress? Do you bake with other people? Do you find it to be a good community kind of experience? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jack Hazen is a licensed psychotherapist at Modern Therapy Group in New York City. He's also a baker who started his own company, Jack Bakes, and he's a regular contributor for Food Network. His new cookbook is called Mind Over Batter, 75 Recipes for Baking as Therapy. Jack, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. I am so happy to be here. I can't even tell you. I'm so excited about this. I love NPR. I love radio. Okay. Love radio. And I'm just really happy to be here.
Fantastic. Well, I'm glad you're here.
I am happy to be.
Now, you'd been baking for your whole life. You're a psychotherapist to different parts of your life. But wait a minute. It hit you that are they really so different? What is it that led you to combine your love of baking, your profession of therapy?
I'll tell you, I had the wonderful gift of having a grandmother who taught me how to bake. And I wasn't one for sports, but I was one for sweets. And so my grandma I would go to my grandma every Thursday after school, and we would bake challah bread in her kitchen. And, you know, we would run through the week. She would tell me what's going on. She'd ask me questions of how I'm doing, how's school going, how are your friends? And, you know, this is a tradition we carried on for years. And it wasn't until I was in school for psychology that I was baking to sort of, you know, in between exams and papers, I was baking, and I was also making some money from what I baked. So it was like two birds, one stone. And I was selling it. And at the end of my semester, I brought bread in for the whole class. And I was like, oh.
And they're like, why? This is delicious. And because I feel like I have to give up baking for therapy. And my professor, Renee Exelbert, who I adore, she said, Jack, baking is therapy. And oven light moment went off in my head. I was like, oh my God, that's it. She put a name to something I've been doing all along for decades, but actually literally from when I'm a kid, which is baking as a way to soothe, as a means of self-care, as a way to create. So during the pandemic, I was making videos and, you know, baking therapy videos. And that's when it kind of got some buzz. And I figured, okay, how do I share this with everyone? Because not everyone, is familiar with baking therapy. And so that's how I put the book together, and with the help of my agent, of course, and all that.
Now, if I was your patient, Jack, if I was your patient, and I, you know, I need some help with anxiety or whatever, how would you apply baking therapy? What would you have me doing?
Good question. How about this? I can answer that with how I did it the first time with a patient. How about that?
Great.
And by the way, here's the crazy thing, everyone. This is actually still a patient of mine all these years later. So whatever I did worked, right? Whatever I did worked. So there I am. I wanted to be the type of therapist that I just wanted to be different. I wanted to not be this, you know, I don't want to be like an old guy and, you know, a number of years just sitting there and nodding and writing notes. I want to be active and engaged in the session, and I want to ask questions. And, you know, I kind of threw out the idea of being a blank canvas. I wanted to do this whole thing differently. And so I had a client come in, and she's sitting across from me, and, you know, I felt that she was really guarded because she didn't know me. So here I am, I'm asking her to divulge her deepest, darkest secrets. And she's like, who is this guy? And, you know, and it didn't matter how spiffy I looked. She was like, you know, and I kept trying to, like, you know, ask a different type of question. And then I said, hey, I have an idea. Like, why don't we step into the kitchen? And I remembered what my professor told me, and I remembered what helped me ease up, calm down, and sort of open up a bit. And that, to me, that was baking. And we went into the kitchen at my, this was back in the day, y'all, when it wasn't virtual therapy. You actually went to a shrink's office. And I was lucky enough to have a work at a fancy schmancy private practice in Bryant Park, Manhattan, that had a full kitchen. And so there were actually baking ingredients, nothing crazy. We made a variation of a mug cake, and we were just baking and, you know, mixing together the ingredients and talking about flavors. And it happened on its own where she started to sort of trust me. Like, we were working together towards the same thing, and it gave her it was an invitation for her to connect. And she did. And then as we were baking, that's when it all started coming out. Here's what's going on. And then after it was done, she said, you know, I feel really accomplished. I feel really good. And that reminds me of this other thing that's going on in my life. And then we were talking as we ate what we baked. And I just felt it to be a really beautiful way to connect with someone, to get your mind off of what's going on and into something else, you know, into creating. And I tell people, you know, if you can't really, you know, access a therapist when you're going through something at home, turn the kitchen into your sanctuary. Whip together a few ingredients, and you'll see the magic that comes from not only creating, but letting go of perfectionism and just going with the flow, going with a process, whatever that is for you. If it's cookies, if it's a cake. But creating something and then sharing it with somebody after. And I call that building community through carbs. So that's a mouthful.
Talking to Jack Hazen on Food Friday. Jack's a licensed psychotherapist and a professional baker. His new cookbook is called Mind Over Batter, 75 Recipes for Baking as Therapy. Now, you organize not by the type of baking, but by the type of mental health practice associated with the recipes. One of those is mindfulness, and that seems to fit really well to me with baking. What is it about baking that really engages our mindfulness?
Yeah, so that's actually one of my favorite. They're all my favorite chapters. I can't really say which one's my favorite, but that one, you know, I spent a little extra time on that one. Being mindful is not a full mind. I know it's kind of tricky. Being mindful is more being present, and you know, have you ever tried to bake something and not be present?
Oh,
I
yeah.
don't know how that would it, come out.
Oh,
right?
It comes out it's bad. Like, I'll tell you.
You know, you like imagine getting it and you're like texting and like talking to someone like while you're trying to make like a meringue. I'm pretty sure you would have a really, you know, not great outcome. So what I love about baking is that it kind of forces you to be present, to be mindful of what you're doing. And for me, I think with today, and I've got to say, guys, I am like the, you know, definitely not innocent here. The scrolling, the texting, there's always something else going on. There's always this empty promise that the next moment is more important than this one, because it's nonstop and life has become so fast paced. That we forget about the present moment. We forget to just be fully there. And I think baking really helps you get there, because it's sort of like this, you know, there's steps, right? You just have to read the step. Like it's, you know, okay, step one, I need to crack the eggs. And step two, I need to combine this. And while you're doing that, you know, you realize that you're in flow with the present moment. So, by the way, some people get there through like yoga and meditation, mm-hmm. and we even have a baking meditation, but I think you could definitely get to a place of mindfulness, you know, presence, centered, calm, grounded by doing something. To me, that was baking, you know?
Now, I don't want people to get the impression that this is just a book about therapy. You've got recipes in this thing, and I want to give one a look. We're going to get this up. It's up at WPR.org/Food Friday. You got these s'mores-based cookies. You had me at, you know, s'mores cookies. Tell us about these and why they're delicious and why they're a good mental health practice, too.
Oh, so... First off, that is, you got to try to make, are you into s'mores and do you like cookies?
Yeah. Everybody who's watching, who's listening now says, what are you talking about, Jack? Yes. Rob loves cookies. Okay. Rob loves s'mores. Yes. I have a sweet tooth.
Oh my gosh. You know, for me, baking brings back memories. I mean, flavors. And what I mean by that is like the flavors and the aromas and just the, you know, the mouthfeel, like we can be transported back to a different time through what we bake. For me, my greatest memory is s'mores, is making s'mores with friends out in my parents have a beach place in the Jersey Shore. And I just, for me, this recipe was the thing that took me back to being around friends, being with people, even if it's like February, right? And so I always say, create, you know, bake and tap into memories through your baking. For me, it was that. What I also love about the s'mores recipe, y'all, is it's a great recipe to make with a friend or a partner or someone you're dating that you're not sure if they're your partner yet. But it's just a great, there's teamwork in there. While you're doing the marshmallows, I'm making the batter. While you're making the batter, I'm getting the chocolate chips ready. It's fun. So it's like, I know it's not a bonfire, but you're still coming together with something delicious to eat, you know?
It's Food Friday. We're talking to baker and licensed therapist Jack Hazen. His new cookbook is Mind Over Batter, 75 Recipes for Baking as Therapy. You can find that recipe for cookies. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got a link there. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you bake? Is it a form of stress relief for you? What do you like to bake? Do you set aside time to do it? Maybe once a week, every night? I don't know. Call in at 800-642-1234 with your own personal experiences or your questions for our guest about baking as therapy. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Jack Hazen, a New York-based therapist and baker. His new book is Mind Over Batter, 75 Recipes for Baking as Therapy. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Has baking played a role in your mental health? Has it provided stress relief? Did you get into baking in the early days of the pandemic? Did it help you? Did you keep it up? Is it part of your self-care routine? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a couple recipes from Jack linked there as well. Jack, I just mentioned self-care. That's another one of your chapters. Yeah. And I think sometimes we think of self-care as somebody on the TV show goes to the luxurious spa that we couldn't afford.
Yeah.
You say no. I talk about baking as self-care. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, y'all, let me tell you, self-care does not mean a bubble bath. A bubble bath is just a bubble bath. So here is my, you know, I actually, Rob, have this, this set of like guidelines for baking as self-care and what that looks like. So I can run through it really quick if you'd like me to.
Definitely.
Okay, cool. Step one, set the intention. Okay. Before you begin baking, take a moment to set your intention for the activity. Decide to be fully present, enjoy the process, and embrace the opportunity for mindfulness, which we just spoke about. Slow down and be present. Appreciate the textures and the smells. I love number two, right? And colors. So number three is practice deep breathing. So I think why we think about self-care as a bubble bath is because you're sitting there, you're relaxed. You know, it doesn't matter if the kids are screaming because the door is locked and you're all the way upstairs. You know, just practice deep breathing like while you're baking, while you're either, if it's kneading the dough, if it's whisking something, just connect with your breath. Focus on the process. So, you know, we have so much going on, like I said, in our day to day. And self-care is just actually checking in with us. So focus on what you're doing, because that's the choice you're making in that moment. So be there with yourself. The process during the process of baking, Number five, engage your senses. I love this one because, like I said a little bit earlier, like there, aromatherapy is a very powerful way to heal. So, you know, the delicious smells that come from the oven or different spices you use, nutmeg, or, you know, I love to use different like citrus zests, lemon zest, orange zest. And, you know, awaken your senses, you know, and number six, practice gratitude. Big part of self-care is gratitude. Number seven, another big part of self-care is not judging yourself.
That's important for me when I bake.
Right? Yeah. So embrace the imperfections. Look, unless you went to even go to a pastry chef, goes to school, you still screw it up sometimes. So embrace the imperfection. You know, and baking doesn't have to be this like rigid, scary, if I do one thing wrong, baking can be forgiving if you can be forgiving with yourself. So embrace those imperfections. And then number eight, so guys, I'm like a messy baker and my mom would tell you that. I used to like bake at all hours of the night and then leave a huge mess, whatever, mom. Clean with intention. So, you know, just clean with, you know, clean the kitchen, you know, but be there while you're cleaning. Don't just clean like, oh God, I hate the cleaning part, because no one really loves the cleaning part. But if you clean with intention, I think you'll enjoy it a little bit more. So that's just my self-care for baking recipe.
Talking to therapist and baker Jack Hazen on Food Friday. His new book is Mind Over Batter, 75 Recipes for Baking as Therapy. Still time for you to call. Maybe everybody's baking right now. I don't know. 800-642-1234. If you find baking to be good for your mental and emotional well-being, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And Jack, we've got another recipe. Again, we have this link to on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And this gets into some of the physicality we can get into baking. We've got the Slap It Together Focaccia. You learned this on a trip to Italy, I think you wrote. Tell us a bit about this Slap It Together Focaccia.
Yeah, I mean, if you're on planet Earth, there's going to be a point in your day. I don't know if it's sitting in bumper to bumper traffic, or you know, the route, you're going to want to slap something, right? And so, this recipe, which I learned from my grandma, but I also learned this. Made a beautiful focaccia recipe for my mom's birthday in Italy. And so this recipe, if you're feeling frustrated, if you want to let go of that of stress, it's the perfect recipe to do so, because you use the dough as your very own stress ball. You knead it, you let it out. And the process that I named this recipe after is, you have to slap the dough to activate the gluten, right? So why not just slap it and let it all out onto that dough? Because the more you let out onto that dough, the better the bread is going to be. It's the more fluffy, the more it's going to rise. And so I like this recipe because you're sort of transforming sort of like tense, stressful energy into something fluffy and delicious.
Now, Jack, I want to talk about, you know, baking sometimes can feel a little stressful to me because I'm more of a cook than a baker myself. But you hit right off the bat in your book one of the reasons it can be stressful. You talk about the importance of laying out all your ingredients first, having everything ready to go. Because I'm the guy who's like, I'm going to start doing the thing and I'll find the stuff as I go. And yeah, that never works out so great. Why is that so important to set our stage so well?
Oh my gosh. Well, I got to tell you, you and I have that in common, because I still get, like, I just get all giddy for like the finished product. And I'm just like, I'll get the baking powder when I need the baking powder. And let me just start. And it never works. So it's something that I taught myself, like, you know, be organized. It creates for the baking process to run a bit more smoothly, no pun intended. So instead of like worrying about like rummaging for ingredients, if it's all laid out, I think you're creating a nice flow in the kitchen with your baking. And you know organization is something we kind of have to practice, you know, because you want your attention to be on what you're doing, not like finding something and putting this away. And I think where it gets really tricky is when you don't sort of lay it out, you're more likely to forget just a little something. Mm-hmm. you know, and then that's kind of going to change the finished product. So, you know, baking is like, you know, preparation meets the opportunity of baking. It creates a delicious baked good.
And Jack, we just have a couple minutes left. I don't want to let the time go by without asking you about challah bread, one of your specialties at your business. Jack Bakes, one of the things that got you into the baking business in the first place. What is it that's magical for you about challah bread?
Challah for challah. What is magical about challah bread? You know, I didn't know it was so magical. It was just like I got so good at it because I would bake it with my grandmother. You know, I brought it to a Shabbat dinner once. And guys, we don't have a lot of time, but I'm going to cut right to the chase. It was a Shabbat dinner at the Kabbalah Center that I was invited to. And I was seated next to Madonna's daughter. I brought my challah bread like I do all the time. And she called Madonna over. Madonna tried the bread and she's like, "You, did you bake this? This is incredible. Can you bake me one every week? I'll say it with my assistant." No joke. That's how I knew this challah bread was. Everyone else, it wasn't me that felt my challah bread was special, but everyone else, including the Queen of Pops, I was like, "Oh God, Jack, you have something here." And so I don't know. The challah bread, it's like fun to make. People love it. It's tasty. You could do anything with it. French toast. And it's just, I don't know. To me, it enhances any meal, you know? And Madonna liked it. So, I mean, is that kind of...
It's hard to go wrong.
You know, I think it's hard to go wrong.
Jack, yes, we'll leave exactly. It there. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
That's Jack Hazen, licensed therapist who started his own baking company, Jack Bakes. He's a regular contributor to the Food Network, and he's with us on Food Friday sharing his new cookbook, Mind Over Batter, 75 Recipes for Baking as Therapy. There's still time for you to share your baking as therapy practices. If you have one, head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us what you like to bake and how you use it, if you use it as stress relief. And while you're there, we've got a link to a couple of recipes that Jack shared with us today. We've got those s'mores cookies. He said, "Do you like s'mores? Do you like cookies?" And I don't know if you heard like my jaw drop. Like, yes, I like s'mores and cookies. I do. And also a recipe for that focaccia that you get to slap around a little bit in the cooking process. Again, find that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it's the State Capitol Report. It's budget season here in Wisconsin, and Kate gets an update from a member of the powerful Joint Finance Committee in the state legislature. As always, you can join in the conversation with your thoughts and questions. That's Monday morning at 7:30 on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's Joint Finance Committee yesterday approved the creation of a fund of $125 million to deal with PFAS contamination here in Wisconsin. That exceeded what Governor Evers put forth in his latest budget proposal on the issue. PFAS is a long-lasting chemical tied to a number of health risks. It's been found in significant amounts in water and communities around the state. The committee didn't specify how exactly the money would be spent. Earlier in the week, though, several Republican lawmakers did introduce a bill that would help provide grants to communities struggling with PFAS contamination. We're going to look at what's in the proposal and the significance of the new PFAS fighting fund, starting with one of the lawmakers who sponsored that bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this an issue in your community? Do you live somewhere that's impacted by PFAS? What kind of problems has that caused for you, your neighbors, your local government and utility? Do you see any solutions in the works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. State Senator Eric Wimberger is a Republican representing Senate District 30, which includes Green Bay, Marinette, and Peshtigo. He's a member of Joint Finance. Senator Wimberger, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Can you talk about this $125 million decision you made to fight PFAS in the state?
Sure. I think it's just kind of a culmination of several years of figuring out what's going on. Although we've known that PFAS was around for, you know, obviously quite some time, we're still dialing in the minutia of what's needed and how to approach a situation. And I think knowing that at the end of the day, it's probably going to be more than a $125 million obligation to fix things over the course of time. This was a good start, and I'm glad the committee and hopefully the legislature will agree with me that that it's something we need to take seriously like we have.
This is affecting communities around the state. In your neck of the woods there in northeastern Wisconsin, what are you hearing from your constituents, your local communities?
I, you know, in my area, I think it's unique in that we have the all three types of ways that the known ways that PFAS is getting into things. And the first is directly from industry, where there's testing at a particular plant here in the area that goes into the ground, and then it migrates to the aquifer, particularly getting closer to the Bay of Green Bay, and then also into neighborhoods. And then we have airports where, in an effort to save lives, there's testing on testing for high temperature fires in airports. And we have airports here and up north that where the same thing is going on. The PFAS is going into the ground and then migrating around. And then also quite separately and uniquely, our biosolids that I was able to discover and figure out over the last couple of years, to a degree that a municipality, for instance, with a wastewater treatment plant, will take leachate in particular, and this is why it's kind of going all over the state, is leachate from a landfill, so that the landfill has stuff in it that has PFAS, and then the leachate goes to the bottom of the landfill. Municipality will take that for a fee and treat it, but then the biosolid that's left, they give to farmers as free fertilizer, essentially to cut on costs of relandfilling that. And I think unbeknownst to many municipalities, you know, there's PFAS in there. They weren't testing for it. And it's all over farms. So we have a combination of all that going on.
I think there's bipartisan agreement. It seems like that we need to do something. There needs to be some kind of investment. Your Democratic colleagues on Joint Finance and elsewhere has raised concerns that there aren't enough standards here. Senator Kelder Royce said during one of the hearings, quote, you can't do it with money alone. You have to have standards. You have to have testing. You have to have accountability. And she and her Democratic colleagues saying they're not seeing that from what you're putting forward here. What's your response?
As a general policy in the budget, we've focused entirely on fiscal applications. And it wasn't just related to PFAS. It's just a blanket, no policy in the budget. We're not going to bog that down with everybody fighting over policy inserted in the budget. So the money being allocated, and then there'll be trailer bills to, you know, hash it out on the floor of the legislature on how to do things in more specificity. But yeah, obviously there has to be regulations. Unfortunately, the DNR has kind of had 5 years now to take a crack at this and have failed in the regulatory administrative law process, which I'm not particularly happy about. I think those things will eventually work through. And there's nothing really stopping the DNR from doing regulations right now under Section 292, the spills law. They can do it right now if they were so inclined, and I hope they do.
Talking to State Senator Eric Wimberger from the Green Bay area, looking at PFAS in the state budget and in legislation. And let's talk about testing now. You're a co-sponsor on a bill you introduced this week that includes grants to localities to help them with PFAS testing. Can you tell us a little bit about how that could work?
Yeah, you've got not only the stuff going into the treatment plants, but the stuff going out. And, you know, half the stuff going out is the quote unquote clean water that is a surface water discharge most of the time into a stream or the Great Lakes. And, you know, you got to make sure that's right. And that just costs a lot of money to be able to test or even to get your treatment plant geared up to be below what's going to be presumed a particular level, I guess. We will be in Wisconsin by Chapter 160 obligated to adopt whatever the federal standards become. And right now the EPA is in a notice and comment period on PFAS for the groundwater standards. There already is a surface water standard that's been issued with various levels for the various types of PFAS. And when all that stuff starts to roll through in the next year or two, you know, we will be obligated to adopt those, and we got to kind of be on the front end of being able to address that.
You mentioned you see the DNR having at least some authority here. Do you have thoughts on, you know, making it very clear what kind of regulatory power the DNR would have, including to hold polluters accountable?
That phrase there is so difficult because on Section 292, a polluter is going to be what's called an equal term. There is what's called an emitter. And an emitter is someone who owns a piece of property, and there's going to be one molecule that transfers from one property to the next property. And when you have people like a farmer who, unbeknownst to them, took a biosolid and it goes down on the water table and shakes out, and then it migrates in the aquifer over to their neighbor, they will be an emitter. And technically, under the spills law, you know, subject to remediation orders, and it'll cause massive devaluations of property. So holding polluters accountable, everybody likes that platitudinous statement, but we got to dial that in to make sure that the people who, you know, should be responsible are, in fact, responsible.
Do you have thoughts on how to do that for not some, say, a farmer who has a small amount through no fault of their own versus somebody who may have been using an industrial practice for a couple decades?
You know, a lot of that is actually all being litigated at the moment. For instance, Johnson Controls in the northern part of my district is embroiled in a lot of litigation. It's kind of centered around the federal district, and the northern district federal court of South Carolina is kind of where they put all these cases. And that initial settlement a little while back was you know, because of that litigation in Northern District of South Carolina. And I think over the course of time, those things are going to be kind of hashed out. The difficult legal question is going to be that when the municipality gets PFAS, then they tell the farmers that go ahead and use that. I believe, this is my own personal kind of analysis, I believe that to my crystal ball that what's going to end up happening is the courts will consider that an intervening act, and that intervening act might cut the liability tie between manufacturers and the end receiver, which would be the farmers. And then the municipalities themselves, who declared it safe and giving the biosolids, are going to be protected by a sovereign immunity clause in Chapter 292. So at the end of the day, there's going to be a whole lot of people left holding egg at the end. Because of some things, and you can't necessarily change a lot of that in retroactively because of it would be ex post facto. So it's really a difficult legal and personal and health situation all around, and I hope to dial.
Let's bring on a quick call before we let you go, Senator. Jerry is with us in Oconto. Jerry, hi.
Yes, it seems to me, looking at what's being proposed, is the taxpayers are going to be most likely footing the bill. I appreciate that the amount of money given, $125 million or whatever it is going to help in some of the cleanup, but it does seem like we're leaving the polluters off the hook, the people that made the money.
I gotcha, Jerry. Thanks for the call. Senator Wimberger, what do you say to Jerry?
Sure. One of the aspects of what was passed last night is that if there's any sort of recuperation through litigation, it will be put into that PFAS fund. But at the same time, you know, it's the truth of the matter is that people were acting on the orders and direction of the DNR this whole time, and trying to abide by those standards. And that, you know, when municipalities are spreading it around and people are, you know, having Teflon pans and putting fire retardant stuff on their clothing because it's all approved by the government. I mean, we don't want it to be that way, but I think there's going to be litigation that ends up in some recovery, but there is an obligation on us all kind of to get together and fix it.
Jerry, thanks for the call. And Senator Wimberger, thanks again for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks.
That's State Senator Eric Wimberger, a Republican from the Green Bay area. We're talking about a new Republican bill aimed at addressing PFAS contamination around the state, along with funding from Joint Finance Committee. Coming up, we'll get some reactions from a conservation group and an organization that advises rural communities on water use and management. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about new funding for fighting PFAS contamination in Wisconsin water. The state's Joint Finance Committee approved funding last night. Some legislative Republicans released a bill that would address PFAS testing. Peter Burris joins us now, Government Affairs Manager for Wisconsin Conservation Voters. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
And Chris Groh is the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Rural Water Association. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Chris, let's start with you. What's your reaction to what we're seeing and when it comes to funding and the support for testing in the form of grants that we were just talking about with the state senator?
I'm encouraged. I often say we will take every penny that is given out for treatment and testing for water systems. So it's encouraging. Basically, we all have to come together over water, and this is a good first step.
And Peter, can you give us a little more context on this problem and how we got to yesterday's vote in joint finance?
Yes. So I, first want to say, reemphasize that this is all first and foremost about health. So we know that PFAS are highly toxic human-made chemicals. They've been tied to complications with pregnancy, development issues, heart disease, testicular cancer. And the way we see yesterday's decision is that it's really a testament to, first and foremost, the work of impacted community advocates across the state. So for years and years, folks and communities across Wisconsin have been fighting for action on PFAS, folks in Peshtigo and Marinette specifically, and in the senator's district. And so really want to, say thank you first and foremost to them for continuing the fight to make sure that we have action for all impacted community members. It's a testament to the work of Governor Evers and Democrats who have been pushing for funding for our local communities, as well as standards and preventative measures for years. We've seen substantive legislation introduced in both of the past two sessions. And third, I do want to thank Senator Wimberger and members of the Joint Finance Committee for recognizing the need to provide direct support to our communities. With the new standards that Wisconsin implemented last summer, more than 70 Wisconsin communities have detected PFAS contamination, and those communities represent more than 2.2 million Wisconsinites. So I'm really encouraged that this $125 million proposal is demonstrating that there is growing bipartisan support for direct support to directly supporting our communities. Certainly still want to see prevention, phase out of these chemicals, and accountability, but really encouraged by this step.
Now, this affects communities, Chris, big and small. Can you talk about your member organizations in the Rural Water Association and some of the unique challenges they face with a problem like PFAS?
Well, my association represents all the small systems, cities under 10,000 people, mm-hmm. Which is fairly rural. That's about 4.4 million people in the state that we are legislating for and assisting. Basically, we go out and we render technical assistance and training. The big thing for rural systems is costs. There are very big problems in infrastructure in small systems. Many systems are old, ready for an upgrade, but lack of funding the last few years has prevented it. This money will help with some of that. But the big thing we fight for or have a hard time with is the affordability of adding more components to be tested for, treated for, to provide safe water.
Yeah. Is there a concern, Chris, among some of your members that, okay, we might end up with new testing guidelines or even treatment guidelines, and that even with this grant money, that might be unattainable for our local budget?
Yes. All these things always come with a 20% match. So, city might get a grant of $1 million and they have to come up with 20% of that. Most systems run hand to mouth. So there is not that kind of money out there to even come up with the 20% match. More testing means more money. More regulation means more money, means upgrades at the plant. Waste, and most cities have a water and a wastewater situation. So they're hit on both ends. Both ends, I guess you'd say. But it's always coming down to money and the availability of operators. Most cities have one, two, maybe a few more operators, and that's becoming an issue also.
And Peter, with the testing bill, we talked to Senator Wimberger about there, co-sponsoring with Senator Rob Coles. You see some similarities, I think, with what Governor Evers had the proposal. What do you see as at least the potential benefit of this this proposed legislation?
Sure. So I guess, first of all, the challenge again with this funding proposal is that it is not real until we pass this legislation. So we see some really key similarities in terms of municipal grants for local communities, though some differences on the flexibility of those grants. Support for private well owners, support for farmers not responsible for contamination but dealing with it, support for the collection and disposal of firefighting foam. So those are all, you know, some key similarities that we're really excited about that there seems to be growing bipartisan support around. And, you know, at the same time, some key differences. So on the positive end, really excited that the senator's legislation includes investment in research for treatment, disposal, and destruction. It also includes an attempt to reduce cost for testing, which is really important, particularly for private well owners, which is a third of our Wisconsinites. But, you know, some things that are really concerning and that I think are going to make it really difficult to get, you know, potentially really get difficult to get this legislation across the finish line. You know, so on just on the generally negative side, there isn't a call for standards. There isn't additional staffing. And in fact, yesterday, Joint Finance cut staffing at the DNR. So we're asking our DNR to do more with fewer, more actions with fewer resources. There's not accountability included in the proposed legislation. And I think most concerning is that there is a section specific to limitations on DNR actions. So again, you know, it's great that we want the DNR to do more on this issue to make sure that we are protecting our communities from these dangerous forever chemicals. But we need to make sure that that they have the resources to do that.
And Peter, the things you listed, testing, treatment, destruction of PFAS, that's all for stuff that's already in the ground and in the water. How are we doing on preventing it from entering the systems in the first place?
That's a great question. I think we have a long ways to go on that front. So certainly we at Wisconsin Conservation Voters in this legislative session are going to be advocating for legislation that prevents the use of these chemicals so that you know, long-term we are phasing them out and they're not getting into our water systems in the first place.
And Chris, you mentioned the difficulties with that 20% match in some cases. Do you have thoughts on what you might like to see change in this legislation as it moves forward that might help these smaller communities deal with this problem and be able to afford it?
I guess I would piggyback on what Peter was talking about as far as keeping them out of the system to begin with. A lot of it's a function of DNR not being able to do their complete job also because they're getting phased out of the program. But keeping it out is important. Wastewater industry does not use PFAS in any form or shape. So, you know, we are a mandatory acceptor. So whatever happens in our wells and our wastewater plants comes from the outside. I guess it would be nice to have help from that. That's enforcement from DNR. You know, other than that, I guess easier access to the money, maybe grants that don't mandate that we have to match, maybe easier application, you know, things like that that make it more flow through for these small systems.
And Peter, as we wrap up, this is all happening as we're waiting for maybe a big change in federal guidelines on PFAS. What are you watching for when it comes to what we consider minimum or maximum, standards in our various kinds of waters, just in our last few moments?
Sure. Well, we know that the EPA is working on maximum contaminant levels for PFAS. We expect that they'll set a level of around 4 parts per trillion, which is an extremely, extremely low level. It signifies what we are learning about every day, that these chemicals are highly toxic, any level is unsafe. So, but their goal is no detection. So, you know, ultimately, we want to be moving towards the full removal of these chemicals. We're not going to see the standards fully in place for another couple of years. So, but testing and support to our communities to get ahead of this problem as quickly as possible is really key.
Thanks to both of our guests today. We've been talking to Peter Burris, Government Affairs Manager for Wisconsin Conservation Voters, and Chris Groh, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Rural Water Association. And earlier, we heard from Republican State Senator Eric Wimberger, who represents the Green Bay area. We talked with all of them about a new Republican-sponsored bill aimed at fighting PFAS contamination around the state, and the news that the Joint Finance Committee just approved a new $125 million fund for fighting PFAS in Wisconsin. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, many health insurance providers are rejecting more claims than they used to, and the reasons for rejection can be hard to understand. Find out why and find out what you could do if your claim has been unfairly denied. That's coming up Monday on Central Time.